From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the attorneys general of Maryland and Washington, D.C. announced today that they are suing President Trump. Their lawsuit alleges that foreign payments and benefits to the president's private businesses constitute unprecedented constitutional violations. D.C. Attorney General Carr Racine and Maryland AG Brian Frosch, both Democrats, held a press conference today announcing the lawsuit. Here's Carr Racine.
We're concerned that foreign governments are coming to the Trump businesses for the single purpose of currying special favor from the President of the United States so that their interest can get a higher priority than the interest of the American people.
NPR correspondent Jackie Northam joins us from Washington, D.C. She's been following all of this. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Robin.
So this is the first lawsuit of its kind brought by state governments against the president. It alleges that Trump is violating a part of this Constitution called the Emoluments Clause. Remind us again the Emoluments Clause.
Yeah, the little known up until about 6 months ago Emoluments Clause, but it was written into the Constitution as a way to prevent the president and others in high office from benefiting or profiting from their position. So if you take the Foreign Emoluments Clause, you know, the president makes trade policies, he decides relations with other countries, and so you don't want him or her to be influenced by foreign countries or their representatives, you know, by giving him gifts or any type of benefits. And many ethics experts believe this is what's happening with the President Trump. You know, you have foreign diplomats staying at his hotels or his resorts all over the world, and that Trump is benefiting from those profits.
Well, and particularly harming, they are claiming, D.C. and Maryland.
Well, yes. In this case, you know, this case is actually partially about the violation of Foreign Emoluments Clause. The attorneys general pointed out that Saudi Arabia has paid the Trump Organization hundreds of thousands of dollars so far for the use of the Trump Hotel here in D.C. But the suit is also about domestic emoluments. And the attorneys general today say that Trump's businesses are putting them at a competitive disadvantage. So take the Trump Hotel here in D.C. as an example. They say it's pulling away from other hotels in the region and that Trump is personally actively marketing these places. The attorneys generals are also arguing that the states that have Trump businesses, such as Mar-a-Lago in Florida, are giving the president benefits through tax breaks and the like.
Right. Well, and didn't President Trump, by the way, put his businesses into a trust to be managed by his sons, Eric and Donald Jr., although that doesn't satisfy the critics.
He's the sole beneficiary of that trust, and that's part of the problem. You're right. He did say he was going to step away from day-to-day operations of his business empire, hand it over to his two adult sons and a longtime associate. But the thing is, because he has not divested himself from his assets, he's still profiting from his businesses. And, you know, he's keeping tabs on them. His son, Eric, admitted that his father is given periodic updates about how the business is doing. And, Robin, let's face it, I mean, Trump regularly visits his golf resorts, his hotels. He hosts foreign leaders at these places, so he knows what's going on. And the lawsuits point out that there's this blurring of Trump's public duties and his personal business interests.
Yeah. Well, this isn't the only lawsuit. In January, the nonprofit watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, sued President Trump. A D.C. restaurant group filed in March. You know, they're claiming, hey, he can get more people to his restaurant and his hotels than we can get. But what is the standing of those lawsuits?
Well, the CREW lawsuit, you know, they filed it again because he's doing a number of businesses with foreign entities all over the world and he's making it. And just on Friday, the Justice Department pushed back on this. You know, it said that CREW lacked any sort of standing to sue because they can't allege that specific harm is being caused by Trump's businesses. The DOJ, the Department of Justice, said the Trump's businesses are legally permitted to accept payments from foreign governments while he's in office. So they got to push back on that. The other lawsuit by this restaurant, it's still sort of static at this point. It's a small restaurant called Cork here in Washington, D.C., and it's saying this big, you know, a Trump hotel is taking all our business. So,
yeah. So the Justice Department filed its first legal brief, again, as you said, saying they do think the president has legal standing. But you talked to Larry Tribe, Harvard constitutional law professor.
I did. And he's actually now the general counsel of this government watchdog group called Campaign Legal Center. Ed, and I'll just play you a small clip here of what he had to say.
Maryland, D.C. make a very compelling case for standing and how they're being harmed. And I think that it is something the courts are going to have to take very seriously.
But he would not be pushed on how he thinks that'll do. Of course, with the crew lawsuit, it did not do so well. It was pushed back by the Department of Justice. This one could, you know, the one filed today could do better. But, you know, the fact is, Robin, this is all new. No president has ever been sued under the Emoluments Clause until now. So it's all brand new territory.
Boy, some of the briefings are talking about, you know, George Washington selling produce abroad. You know, we're going back that far. By the way, Larry Tribe, we should mention, has also been writing about impeachment of President Trump. So he has some opinions there as well. NPR's Jackie Northam, this is fascinating. We'll continue to follow it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You know, one day some grammar authority is going to let us finally say what we want to say when talking about two attorneys general, which is attorney generals.
but
you can't
yet.
Do it right now.
Right.
Well, federal immigration agents arrested more than 50 people in Central California last week and dozens more in a high-profile sting in the Detroit area over the weekend. It's part of President Trump's order to crack down on immigrants living illegally in the United States. Immigration arrests jumped 40% in the first few months of the administration. Now, the federal agency in charge of enforcing that order is trying to calm residents in neighborhoods across the country that are increasingly on edge. And local groups aren't quite sure what to make of it. Liz Jones from Here and Now contributor KUOW has this report from Seattle.
Good morning, everyone.
A young mom with a stroller takes a seat in front as about 50 people fill the pews at this church in Bellevue, Washington, on a Thursday morning. Many are advocates for immigrants, and they're here to talk with Melissa Nitsch. She's a community relations officer with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE.
So a little bit about me. I am a Northwest native as well. I grew up in
Nitsch is part of a new team ICE launched last year with about two dozen officers across the country. The goal is to build support for her agency at the local level with police, community groups, and the public.
It's definitely an uphill battle, but I get to come to things like this and talk to people and share information.
Nitsch starts off with an overview of her work, delicately sidestepping politics.
So, of course, we all know that we had an election and new president who came in with a lot of different ideas from the previous administration.
As presidents and policies change, she wants people here to see her as a source of reliable information. Like when rumors fly around about immigration raids, she says call her. She can check on it.
We don't go out and conduct raids. We're not doing checkpoints. When we are going out to look for somebody, we know who we're looking for.
Except now, ICE also has broader authority to arrest anyone else they encounter during these targeted operations. That's spelled out in one of President Trump's executive orders and new guidelines about how to implement it. All eyes are on Nitsch, quietly taking this in. She pauses for a minute, lets out a deep breath, and keeps going. She knows this audience likely views her outreach efforts with skepticism. Most work directly with undocumented families as city employees, lawyers, school staff, and social workers. Some are immigrants themselves. Later, the mom with the stroller up front calls it out.
I'm sorry, this is going to come out sounding really blunt, and I'm not trying to be mean
okay.
at all, but I do feel that it does need to be said because I know a lot of us are thinking it.
This woman's a U.S. citizen. Her husband is undocumented, so she only gave her first name, Alicia. And her question boils down to, why should we trust you?
What can I say to convince you? I don't know. I mean, I'm coming to you knowing that most people here probably don't really like what my agency is doing, but I'm still willing to talk about it with you and answer all your questions, so I hope that that's compelling.
Tension hangs in the air. Nitsch appears a bit nervous, but the meeting continues on politely.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions. The first question.
Nitsch struggles to be candid, yet also careful with her words. Her job marks a notable shift for ICE, an agency known for staying on script. Most of the people I spoke with after the meeting say they appreciated the chance to talk directly with an ICE representative.
Yeah. I mean, it fights this notion of a bunch of thugs.
This is Mercer Island resident Phil Gerson. He's part of a church group that helps undocumented immigrants.
I think the speaker did as good a job as she can, but, you know, my questions are, has to do with moral issues.
By that, he means he wants ICE to set clear priorities about who's targeted for deportation. Felons, not families, as some say. And it's these families and people who are in the U.S. illegally who are clearly absent at today's meeting with ICE. Debbie Lacey, one of the organizers, says that's no surprise.
and people are so frightened that they're not going to put themselves at risk by actually showing up where they know an ICE person will be.
Lacey is with the Eastside Immigrant and Refugee Coalition. She says this meeting aims to get answers for the immigrants who increasingly turn to them for help. She's hopeful this dialogue with ICE can continue.
We really wanted to set this up as a safe place for all parties and a place where we could just ask questions, get answers, so that we can advocate and push for people's civil rights at this time.
It's a start, and Lacey sees it as worthwhile. As for trust, that will be tricky between a group that wants to protect immigrants and an agency built up to deport them. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones in Seattle.
Memphis is the second largest city in Tennessee, famous for Elvis Presley, Beale Street, and barbecue. It's also a city that is more than 60% Black and one that has been at the center of the nation's racial strife. Memphis is where civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. A new book looks back at the history of race and politics in Memphis, going all the way back to the early 1900s, when Edward Hull Crump, or Boss Crump, ran the city. He was white, but he successfully courted Black voters, and his influence was such that there were even songs written about him. Here's Frank Stokes in 1927 singing Mr. Crump Don't Like It.
I Mr. Crump don't like it, ain't gonna have it here. I miss the crumb, don't like it, ain't gonna have it, yeah.
Well, joining us now is Otis Sanford, who's a professor of journalism at the University of Memphis and a columnist at the Commercial Appeal. His book is From Boss Crump to King Willie, How Race Changed Memphis Politics. Professor, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And when we hear that song, Mr. Crump Don't Like It, Ain't Gonna Have It Here, tell us about Boss Crump. Who was he?
Well, that song is exactly accurate. Boss Crump was the undisputed political and just overall boss of Memphis for almost 50 years. He was only mayor a short period of time, a congressman for two terms, but he ran Memphis and Shelby County and a lot of Tennessee politics for most of his adult life. He was just a political figure that there's never been one like him before or after.
And he was kind of the first white mayor in Memphis who realized that he was going to need Black voters in order to win.
Absolutely. You know, African Americans were voting in Memphis long before they were in other parts of the South, especially neighboring Mississippi and Arkansas and even over in Alabama. But they were voting here. There was a pretty sizable African American middle class here. He tapped into that, did it well, listened to some concerns of African-Americans when nobody else was listening, and endeared him to the African-American community almost all of his political life.
How did he appeal to Black voters there? What did he do specifically?
Simple thing. I mean, one thing that I recount in the book, after he got elected, he was first elected in 1909, African-Americans wanted their own park. They were not allowed to go to white-owned parks. They did not have a park for themselves except for one that Black millionaire Robert Church had made for them down on Beale Street. But no other white leader in town would even listen to or entertain the idea of a Black park. Boss Crump did. He thought that they deserved one. And so he made it happen despite the reluctance of all the other Black officials. And he created Douglas Park, named after Frederick Douglass, that still exists today.
But as you point out in the book, that park is not exactly the most wonderful location. This African-American park was far out of town and it was hard to get to.
No question about it. Not now. It's part of the city because the city expanded. But back in 1914, when it officially opened, yeah, it was so far out you had to take a trolley car, get off the trolley car, get on wagons or walk on foot just to get to the desolate area. But African Americans were nonetheless happy about it, and they supported Boss Crump for the most part the rest of his career.
Now, there's no doubt that he was a segregationist, but you write about whether or not he used the N-word. Was he a racist?
I think there's an argument to be made that he probably was. I say to audiences that he was just a product of his time. I don't think there's any question that he used the N-word more than once. It's been documented, and I documented it in the book, even though his family says he didn't. But he did. But again, he was a product of his time. He held the counsel of prominent African-Americans in town who respected him, supported him, came to him with their concerns, and he addressed those. So, yes, he was a staunch segregationist, never thought that an African American should hold public office. But, you know, you can make an argument that he was a racist. But in those times, pretty much every white person in this area had racial tendencies.
Well, he died in 1954, and the city didn't elect a black mayor until Willie Harrington was elected in 1991. Why do you think it took so long for that to happen, even after Boss Crump had shown the importance of the black vote in Memphis?
Well, it wasn't for a lack of trying. African Americans had long wanted a voice in political life in Memphis. They sought it, but there was a lot of strain going on. There was a lot of resistance. You know, Memphis didn't get the attention that a Birmingham got or places in Mississippi for racial violence. They kept the violence down in Memphis. But in terms of African Americans getting into political office, the majority white population that existed in Memphis until 1990, they just were not going to have it. And it was only until 1990 when African Americans had the legitimate chance, because of the change in population, to elect an African American mayor.
Why did they call him King Willie?
Well, during his during his time in office, he was a very dominant guy, strong mayor. That title was conferred on him by a local radio personality who actually used to be a colleague of mine at the Commercial Appeal, a guy by the name of Mike Fleming, just because, Dr. Harrington, did not suffer fools, and he fought back, and he controlled the African-American vote in this town throughout his long tenure as mayor. And so when Mike Fleming called him King Willie, the moniker stuck.
Now, when we talk about racial politics in Memphis, of course, one of the big events in the history there is the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King. You were 14 when he was killed in your city. What do you remember about that?
I've been a news junkie ever since I was a young boy. And so I paid attention to what was going on. And I watched the news, read the newspapers. I remember that day emphatically. I was in the ninth grade. I lived about 40 miles outside Memphis, but Memphis was my area of influence. I just remember the sadness, the violence, both here and in other parts of the country when that happened, the sheer reluctance of the mayor at that time, a guy by the name of Henry Loeb, who would not give in to the city sanitation workers' demands, even though others were trying to get him to do so. He was backed by the newspaper and the white power structure in town. So I just remember that as being one of the saddest and most dangerous moments in the city's history. And it changed the political trajectory of Memphis, because it was one of two things that caused white flight to the suburbs that changed the voting demographics of Memphis.
And made it more African-American.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. With each census that was taken after 1968, African-Americans continued to gain and gain and gain, and then they became the dominant population in the 1990 census.
What about Memphis's place economically? I mean, as you point out in this book, at certain times in its history, it's been a real economic engine in the region. Today, especially when you compare it to, let's say, Nashville in Tennessee, it's a much poorer city. Do you see Memphis finding its way back to being just a major economic engine?
Well, the only thing I can do is hope so, and I think most Memphians hope so. Yes, we've been overtaken by Nashville in terms of population, although that's metro population. I think that Memphis has suffered a lot because of our racial divide, even though we've had it for most of its existence. And you're right. Memphis was always the center of economic life in the Mid-South, based on cotton back in the early 1900s. But FedEx is still here. AutoZone is here as corporate headquarters. There is an effort to revitalize the city. So, I mean, people are optimistic. But I don't think we're moving as fast as we should be moving. And a lot of that has to do, again, with, I think, racial differences, poor educational opportunities for a lot of citizens, and the poverty that is just really high in Memphis.
One of the things I remember about a trip that I took to Memphis is that I was doing a story about the FedEx facility there, and that the people in Memphis who had to deal with these overnight flights because FedEx flies in all these planes and flies them all out every single night, nobody cared about the noise from the planes because they knew that that was where all the jobs were coming from, that that FedEx facility is so important. I just thought that was such a nice thing about Memphis.
Well, that is absolutely true. As a matter of fact, I lived down near the airport back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I got rousted every night by the planes, but I certainly wasn't bothered by it. I got used to it because I knew that FedEx is the economic driver of Memphis.
Hmm. So what's your favorite thing about Memphis that you would want people, especially who haven't been to Memphis, to know?
Well, Memphis just has a whole lot of soul, and that's not just related to music or related to food. You mentioned barbecue. Memphis is a friendly town. The weather is nice. The cost of living is really, really good when you compare it to other cities. Yes, we have our problems, but I've lived in four other major cities in my lifetime, and Memphis is no worse than some of them. I just think that Memphis, you know, people are friendly, people are kind. Yes, we have our political and racial differences, but overall, Memphis is a great place to be if you like music, if you like culture, if you like history, and if you like a good barbecue sandwich on a Friday night.
Who doesn't like that? Otis Sanford, a professor of journalism at the University of Memphis. His book is called From Boss Crump to King Willie, How Race Changed Memphis Politics. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Shares of General Electric rose in early trading today on the news that GE's longtime CEO and chairman Jeffrey Immelt is stepping down. Immelt has led GE since 2001, and this morning, at a company meeting broadcast on Facebook Live, he said it was time for a change.
16 years is a long time to run this company, even though I love you all dearly. It's long enough, and change is good.
Immelt will be replaced by John Flannery, the president and CEO of GE Healthcare. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So GE stock has dropped more than 10% this year, while the market overall has been doing pretty well. Is that what this CEO shakeup is about?
Yes, partially. But we should also note that GE has been under a lot of pressure from something called an activist investor. That's a big institutional manager who comes in, makes an investment in a company, and basically tries to have a big sway. And this particular investor, Trian Fund Management, run by billionaire Nelson Peltz, has really been agitating for GE to cut costs and increase their profitability, especially in the company's core industrial businesses. And obviously, this did not happen fast enough. And I think this pressure, along, as you said, with the stock price being down this year, after many years, frankly, that this was a move that many people weren't expecting, but they weren't surprised by either.
Well, and when you look at what GE is doing in its businesses, and it does a lot of things all over the world, but one of the things that it's been famous for a long time is light bulbs. GE was co-founded by Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb. And last week, GE announced it's selling its light bulb business.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, the company really turned into something so much beyond the original conception. It was like a multinational conglomerate, the likes of which we had not seen. And really what the last 5 to 8 years has been is a refocusing of the energy on what they say is their core business, their industrial business. So the company had been shedding lots of different units, not just light bulbs, but home appliances, and frankly, also their financial services. GE Capital had grown into a huge business, and they kind of made that into a skeleton of itself. So I think that this is a sort of a double-edged sword, which is we've got to really reduce our profits. We have to reduce our costs, and we have to increase profits. We've got to get out of these businesses that aren't part of our core.
What is Immelt's legacy going to be then? I mean, he came in 4 days before the 9/11 terror attacks, and as you said, you know, during the financial crisis, because of GE Capital, they were right in the center of that as well. He's been through a lot there.
Yeah, he has. I mean, look, he has been part of this initiative to really cut down on the core, into the core businesses. But, you know, he also has not been afraid of mergers and acquisitions. A few years ago, they took over a power business of a French giant Alstom. They also agreed to merge their oil and gas division with another services provider, Baker Hughes. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's fascinating because you see that this guy has gone through a lot. He was able to wind down GE Capital. But look at the price of the stock since his tenure. Down 30% right. since 2001. The S&P 500, it has more than doubled. GE should be closer to market performance, and it really has fallen short under Immelt's reign.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
It's here and now. At last night's Tony Awards, Dear Evan Hansen picked up 6 Tonys, including Best Musical and Best Score for Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, who earlier this year won an Oscar for their work on La La Land. And musician Alex Lacamoire won his 3rd Tony for his orchestrations of Pasek and Paul's work. He also was the music supervisor and producer of the Evan Hansen Cast album, which debuted at number 8 on Billboard's album chart in February, the highest debut for a cast album in over 50 years. Oh, and Lacamoire's other 2 Tonys were for his work with Broadway superstar Lin-Manuel Miranda on In the Heights, and the musical Miranda debuted at the White House in 2009 with Alex on piano.
Tonight, I'm accompanied by Tony and Grammy-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered or carted away across the waves, our Hamilton kept his guard up.
That, of course, went on to become Hamilton the Musical. So it's not surprising, really, that Alex Lacamoire is involved in the current Broadway hit, Dear Evan Hansen. It tells the story of Evan, a high school loner who becomes popular when he's mistaken for a friend of a classmate who'd taken his life. Evan goes along with the fiction. In March, Alex Lacamoire joined us to talk about Dear Evan Hansen. It was so exciting what you do.
I feel lucky.
But what exactly do you do?
It depends what facet of my job we're talking about. As a music supervisor, my job is to basically manage everything music related in the show. In the case of Dear Evan Hansen, it was being there for rehearsals and helping to teach the cast the music, being the liaison between the director and the cast and the music director and the composer and the sound department. So kind of just globally overseeing the music. Mm-hmm. As the orchestrator, my job was to take the music that Pasek and Paul had written and figure out how to make it fit on a band, decide when to use the strings, on what songs do I want to use the strings, and if they are playing strings, are they bowing, are they plucking, are they playing loud, are they playing soft?
All we see is sky for forever. We let the world pass by for forever. Feels like we could go on for forever this way. 2 friends on a perfect day.
I was actually one of the producers for the cast album, and being in the studio to mix it, being in the studio to master it, all that stuff that goes into making the record a complete product.
So, you do a lot.
I do a lot.
Let's just listen to, on Dear Evan Hansen, one of the pieces that the main character, Evan, played by Ben Platt, sings. We understand when Justin Paul played Waving Through a Window, this song, on the piano in your apartment, you said, "I'm in." As we listen, what did you think?
I've learned to slam on the brake before I even turn the key, before I make the mistake, before I lead with the worst of me.
As soon as I heard the song, it just hooked me. It's so unbelievably melodic. It's so catchy, and it just sticks with you. There's such a longing to the music. There is such a yearning to it. It just aches in the most beautiful way.
On the outside, always looking in, will I ever be more than I've always been? 'Cause I'm tap, tap, tapping on the glass.
And what you did with this song and others on Evan Hansen is why Lin-Manuel and others involved with Hamilton and In the Heights say that you provide the DNA for their shows. For Hamilton, for instance, what we heard your performance at the White House, just a very bare bass piano line. Were you already hearing in your head, here's what I want to do?
You know, it's very funny. At that moment, no. When we performed at the White House, I think I was just trying to figure out how to make a hip-hop song work with just a piano and, like, not have any drums. And,
I know, there's
and
the president.
Exactly. So at that moment, all I was thinking about is how to make the piano just be an orchestra, how to make it rock. But it wasn't until a while later, as we got through workshops, that Lynn suggested to me, hey, you know, I want the strings to be to Hamilton what the horns were to In the Heights. Hmm. And once he mentioned that, then I started to kind of get a palette in my mind about what this show was going to sound like. And from then on, I started to think in those terms.
The word got around. They said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education. Don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton.
Well, back to Dear Evan Hansen. I mean, do you pinch yourself? We'll listen to a little more of the music, but it's like it's a hit again.
You will be found, so let the sun come streaming in, because you'll reach up and you'll rise again. Lift your head and look around. You will be found.
I feel lucky that I work on the shows that move me, the shows that speak to me, musically speaking. And I just feel lucky that Hamilton did that for me, and that was also working with my friends. Mm. And with Dear Evan Hansen, the strength of the music, the strength of the story, the fact that it happened this way is pure coincidence.
Well, I'm sure you grokked, as they say, with the immigrant storyline of Hamilton. Hamilton being one. You eventually moved to Miami and grew up there, but your parents were born in Cuba. Dear Evan Hansen is a lot about high school loneliness. Your dad suffered an aneurysm when you were four, and he became disabled. And yet, as he recovered as much as he did, both your parents seemed to just dote on this prodigy that they had in their midst, this little kid who could play piano. How much did that upbringing shape who you are?
I feel it greatly did. You talked about Dear Evan Hansen and the loneliness of its character. That's something that I definitely experienced. I feel like I was very focused on my music. You know, I'm someone who would pore over album credits, who would pore over, you know, knowing who the individual members were of every band that I listened to and what went into making music happen. And not everybody has that same kind of obsession about it. So it was kind of hard to find people to relate on that level with because it really consumed me.
Guys like you and me, we're just the losers who keep waiting to be seen, right? I mean, no one seems to care or stops to notice that we're there, so we get lost in the in-between.
Well, there was something else going on, and let's explain. Yes, you were, you know, huddled way too close to the TV or the stereo, your parents started to notice. And it was soon discovered that you have a hearing loss, at least 15%. Yeah. You wear hearing aids. Was that slight deafness the thing that actually forced you to listen closer?
It's possible. Legend has it, when I was two, I would stare at the stereo speaker, just transfixed by the sounds coming out of it. So I think there was something in there that always I was drawn to it. And perhaps my hearing, as you said, makes me listen to music a little bit more closely and makes me more fascinated by it, if you will. Maybe it's all just coincidence. Maybe that it all feeds one thing to the other. But I do believe all that kind of shapes who I am now, and all my for the good and for the bad. It has definitely shaped me.
Well, I'm wondering if this is why you are drawn, at least for now, to Broadway, because of this big wall of sound that you can create.
Well, you know, what I think draws me the most to the theatrical experience, and we talked earlier about what that loneliness feels like, theater is the opposite of that. Theater is community. Theater is family. And the fact that it's a group of all these separate people who have really excellent strengths at something that someone else might not have. And the fact that you rely on each other to create a production, like, okay, I can't get on stage until that light comes on, which means that the stage manager has to tell the light to come on, which means that the conductor needs to play that chord that means the lights are turning on, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all orchestrated, for lack of a better term. And I guess my OCD brain is very drawn to what that is and how all that happens.
Well, we're glad. That's Tony and Grammy-winning musician Alex Lacamoire, orchestrator, music supervisor, cast album producer for the Broadway musical Dear Evan Hansen. We'll link you to some pieces at hearnow.org. Also, Lin-Manuel Miranda's right-hand man, his musical DNA, as he's called him, for In the Heights and Hamilton, a trifecta. Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We spoke to Alex in March. Last night, he won a Tony for his work on Dear Evan Hansen, which won 6 Tonys in all.
The new French president, Emmanuel Macron, is celebrating another victory after parliamentary elections over the weekend. His party, the Republic on the Move party, won a landslide victory in the first round. The second round of voting is this Sunday. And joining us now is Florence Villeminot from France 24. She's in Paris on Skype. Florence, there was a big question about whether Macron would be able to do anything as president because his party controlled no seats in parliament. Now it looks like they'll have almost all of them.
And that was really the key issue for Emmanuel Macron. It was going to be a real challenge for Macron to secure this majority in parliament. And he has done so in such a comfortable way. And it seems like he virtually has no opposition from the conservatives, and certainly no opposition for the socialists, who really had a humiliating defeat yesterday. Remember, they currently have the majority in the parliament, and the most they could win is perhaps between 20 and 30 seats in parliament, which is a huge defeat for them. But the conservatives, they're the second party, I guess you could say, but they're very far behind Emmanuel Macron's party.
So what does this mean for policy in France? If Macron comes in now and has a huge majority and can do anything he wants, what's he going to do?
Well, that's what everyone wants to know. Emmanuel Macron, in the presidential election, drew some criticism for not being very clear about his program. He said he was a little bit on the left, a little bit on the right. There are some things that he has made very clear. He wants to make it easier to hire and fire people. He also wants to reform the pension system, the unemployment benefits system. And he's also said he wants to clean up French politics. In the past couple of months and years, French politics has been hit with scandal after scandal. Now it seems like he does have a majority to push some of those things through. But the real question is, since he's not going to face that much opposition, will he actually do those things? Because there perhaps won't be so much debate. So it's a real mystery as to what's going to happen next.
Is this the end of the far-right party of Marine Le Pen, since her party did so poorly in these parliamentary elections?
Well, the party did poorly compared to what they hoped to do, but it's still going to secure more seats than it currently has. It currently has 2 seats in parliament, and it could get up to 10, which would be quite a large leap for them, even though it would be disappointing. They were hoping for a lot more. The party is going through a major crisis since the presidential election. Internal party divisions, which were already there, have come very much to the surface. There have been calls to rebrand the party, perhaps change its name, perhaps change its leader. So it is going through a crisis, but despite the disappointment, it still is going to be in a more powerful position with respect to policymaking.
How much of Macron's success with the French people has been about being anti-Trump? We think back to what's happened over the last few weeks. There was that white-knuckled handshake between the two of them. There was a moment when Macron was approaching some of the world leaders, and instead of going to President Trump, who was in the center, he veered off and went first to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And then with the Paris Accord, when the U.S. was pulling out of the Paris Accord on climate change, Macron went on French TV and blasted President Trump for his decision and offered Americans disappointed by the decision a second homeland in France. Here he is.
I call on you to remain confident. We will succeed because we are fully committed. Because wherever we live, whoever we are, we all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
Okay, so what do you think? How much of this is about Trump?
Well, it's definitely zingers that have gone viral. And so I guess there's a certain amount of satisfaction in France that that he's been able to stand up to not only Donald Trump, but even Vladimir Putin. When he met Vladimir Putin here in France, he was seen as having a successful interaction and standing up to Vladimir Putin. So standing up to Trump and Vladimir Putin, I guess, are mark points for Macron. But these days, France is focused more on France and not so much on what's going on in stateside, I think.
Are French people getting sick of voting every few days?
They are, actually. There's, I guess, what you could call a certain amount of election fatigue, which might explain a very important factor in this parliamentary election, or at least in the first round, and it's the record abstention rate. French people tend to vote. In presidential elections, for instance, the turnout rate hovers around 80%. Traditionally, in parliamentary elections, it hovers around 60%. But yesterday, it was under 50%. And that is something that's really shocking. That's something that's been getting a whole lot of attention here in France. Hmm. Now, I think the analysis is that people are just tired of voting. But it's a trend that we've been seeing in France over the past couple of parliamentary elections. And a lot of that has to do with the electoral calendar. The parliamentary election comes just about a month after the presidential election, and so people are just a little over French politics. But then there's also another factor, is the fact that so many people were, I guess, disappointed in the presidential election. You know, people who voted for Marine Le Pen or for the far left Jean-Luc Mélenchon, they were disappointed in the presidential election, and so they just decided not to go and vote in the parliamentary election.
That's Florence Villeminot with France 24. Florence, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.